supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
USS New Jersey battleship docked at Camden with its 16-inch anti-aircraft artillery. Place your bets. I'm Peter Crimmins, WHYY News.
And you can find photos of the Kalmar Nickel at newsworks.org. In sports, Penn State hosts Northwestern at noon, South Florida's at Temple, also at noon, and Richmond meets Villanova at 6. The Union hope to stop the revolution at PPL Park tonight at 7. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. We got one of them jam-packed shows for you this week, Cats and Kittens. In the question of the week, we're going to tell you exactly how to use the coming largesse of leaves falling down to ensure that you have a great-looking and healthy, productive garden next season. We're also going to talk to our old friend, the Dirt Doctor, Howard Garrett from Texas, about the disturbing trend of spraying chemicals from airplanes to control West Nile virus and what you should really be doing to keep mosquitoes under control. That's a lot to get done. We better hop right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Dr. Johnson, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Well, thank you for calling.
Well, thank you for being with us today. I should explain to our listeners that we have requested to speak with you because of an amazing centennial that is happening in Texas, and that your grandmother, I believe, started this incredible tomato tradition. Is that correct, sir?
That's right. The shindig is in Cameron, Texas, on the October the 9th, which is a Tuesday, and I'm glad to talk about it because she was the most important influence in my life.
We're talking about Edna Westbrook Trigg,
right?
Who founded the first Girls Tomato Club, as you say, in Cameron, Texas, almost exactly 100 years ago, and it was a precursor, apparently, of 4-H clubs.
Exactly.
And this began in 1912 in what,
right,
I'm presuming was rural Texas, where self-sufficiency could mean the difference between life and death.
You bet, because the electricity was not available rurally, and there was no way to preserve food during the winter, such as was done in the north, because you could dig a cellar to put roots and potatoes in, but they couldn't do that here in this part of the country. So preservation of food and preservation of life was a real struggle before 1912.
And yet I find it fascinating. One of the things that jumped out at me is she used the tomato as like the gathering point. This was the Girls Tomato Club, and
yeah.
I understand they got together with the Boys Corn Club to put on one of the biggest agricultural shows ever seen in Texas at that point.
That's right. There were 3,000 that attended a meeting in Milano, Texas, as one of the first things that happened in the fall of 1912. She had an understanding of how to raise crops from her own personal background. But she had these clubs formed, and the girls were responsible for having to plant, prune, and tie down the tomato plants, and then pick them, and then can them when they had only tin cans to use. And they had to learn to take a soldering iron and put the tomatoes in there, and then put a lid on it, and then cook it.
Oh, so now we're not talking about mason jars where you're boiling glass with lids with a little rubber seal on it.
That came later because they couldn't control the heat of a wood fire, and frequently the mason jar would just break.
I got news for you. My mason jars break even though supposedly I'm supposed to be controlling my heat. We're talking to Dr. W. Cone Johnson, who is the grandson of the great Edna Westbrook Trigg, who 100 years ago formed the Girls Tomato Club in Cameron, Texas. Her achievements are going to be celebrated on October 9th of this year at the courthouse in Cameron. Dr. Johnson, this was highly unusual for a woman to be independent in the early teens, even in the late teens, even through the 20s.
You're right, because women, you know, she was a single lady, but she, you know, this was a time when women didn't work. Now, I was in her presence at such a young age, it never occurred to me that all women didn't work.
In a homestead without electricity, without running water, being responsible for actually not putting the food on the table, but making sure the food got on the table and there was food to get on the table that had been preserved properly. I think the women had it a lot harder than the guys who just got to go off to a job and then come home and say, "What's for dinner?"
I'm sure you're right. It's just that my grandmother never, ever gave the appearance that it was any kind of a big effort or big deal. Even though she worked, you know, 24/7, she was totally dedicated to her work and never stopped.
And it seems, if I'm reading this correctly, that she was the inspiration in many ways for what later became the county cooperative extension agents who did the same kind of work in rural communities.
She was the first such agent in Texas. So the same county now has had 40 agents since then. The agent's job itself was created by the agricultural department and became a salary job. She was paid $30 a month to do the work.
Oh, so she finally did get paid towards the end of her career.
Yes, she did.
That's amazing. Her work has been carried on to this day. I believe, if I'm correct, there still is a Girls Tomato Club?
Well, in a sense, yes, there are. The tomato clubs are pretty small now, a little more scattered, but they still exist, and they serve a lot of good purposes, if for no other reason, to remind themselves that preservation of food is still pretty important.
All right. We've been talking to Dr. W. Cone Johnson, grandson of the legendary Edna Westbrook Trigg, founder of the first Girls Tomato Club in 1912, a precursor of the 4-H, a precursor of the extension system, a woman who traveled throughout Texas keeping families healthy. Her legacy will be celebrated on October 9th at the courthouse in Cameron, Texas. Dr. Johnson, what a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us today, sir.
Bless your heart.
1-888-346-9499. Holly, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Holly. Where are you?
I live in Philadelphia, the Germantown section of Philadelphia.
Okay, you live in Germantown. I mean, for people in Philadelphia, that's like, you got to know a neighborhood when you say Philly.
That's right.
All right, what can we do for Holly in Germantown?
So, the reason I'm calling is I started replanting grass seed in our small backyard.
Okay.
And I followed your instructions and did a lot of research as to how to do it. Everything was going well. So I started it about right at the end of August.
Perfect.
Maybe like a day or two later, we got a bunch of days in a row where it rained.
Right.
The grass seed was coming up beautifully. I had put compost down. And then maybe 3 weeks ago, I noticed that there were these small holes appearing in the dirt, and the new grass was, you know, getting ruined and dug up, and there was little dirt holes coming out from the holes. Anyway, I'd also seen some like swallows and other birds that were landing on the grass and pecking at the grass seed.
I think I know who's making the holes.
Okay.
Haven't you noticed how many squirrels you have in the neighborhood?
Well, so I thought it was squirrels, but I haven't noticed any squirrels. I mean, I see birds, and there's lots of squirrels in the neighborhood, but I haven't caught any squirrels on the grass. I haven't seen a single one.
But you've also never seen what's making the holes.
No, okay.
And the grass that's not affected by this hole still looks really good, right?
Yeah,
okay,
except
good.
That now just the backyard looks awful again. Because
I know,
these
I know.
Patches.
Okay, so here's what we're going to do.
Okay.
The first thing you're going to do is get a motion-activated sprinkler.
Okay.
The biggest brand name is called the Scarecrow. There's a couple of other ones. But you're going to set it up and connect it to your hose, point it at your lawn, and mm-hmm. then you don't have to see whoever's doing the damage. Okay. It, as soon as a bird lands on the lawn, a squirrel comes in, or in my thinking, a skunk in the middle of the night, it will come on and it will chase them away with a couple of cups of cold water, so so that you never have to find the pest. So what I would do is I would try to repair these holes as best I could, just fill them in with a little bit of soil, tamp them down, set up the motion-activated sprinkler. It could be birds, but it's unlikely. I think it's squirrels burying nuts. I'm sure there's lots of black walnuts in the neighborhood. But another option is skunks, who dig who dig in lawns, especially fresh lawns like this, to look for grubs and earthworms. It could even be neighborhood cats using
that
your,
could be it.
Using your fresh lawn as a litter box. That's the nice thing about the motion activated sprinkler is you don't ever have to figure out who done it. You just get rid of them. And you, it's a great investment. You buy it once. You can use it to protect anything you plant. After you get your lawn through this winter and through the spring, if you put a vegetable garden in, you just move it over and point it at the vegetable garden so raccoons and possums and all those urban creatures you have in Germantown don't come into your garden. It keeps out dogs and cats that are roaming around, keeps out nosy neighbors. These things are worth their weight in gold. I could not garden without motion-activated sprinklers.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, good luck, Holly, and don't forget to use corn gluten in the spring and to feed the lawn next fall with something non-chemical.
Okay, sounds good.
All right,
good.
Take
All
care.
Right. Thank you.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll get you ready for fall planting and compost making at the Mount Laurel, New Jersey Library on Sunday, October 7th at 1 and 3 p.m. Then I'll once again be honored to host the Empty Bowl Benefit Dinner for the Homeless at Chestnut Hill College on Wednesday, November 14th. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with how to best harness your fall leaves, what to do instead of spraying to get rid of West Nile virus-carrying mosquitoes, and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, the national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds gardeners that fall is the ideal time to plant gourmet garlic, perennial plants, bulbs for spring blooms, and especially fruit plants. More information at burpee.com.
This is WHYY.
Medford Lees, a not-for-profit community serving those ages 55-plus and guided by Quaker principles, supports WHYY. This fall, there's an opportunity to explore, learn, and discover with Medford Lees as they launch their new Pathways series. Pathways features public programming on topics covering art, politics, music, history, horticulture, and more. Full details about Medford Lees public events, educational programming, and its campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey, are online at medfordlees.org.
Bartlett Tree Expert supports WHYY and offers the removal of hazardous trees and scientific treatments including pruning and disease diagnoses. Locations in Montgomery, Chester, and Bucks counties, and Cherry Hill, New Jersey. More information at bartlett.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up a little later in the show, the fall leaves are about to drop. Are you prepared to shred them and save them and use them to make the greatest garden mulch and the essential, essentially fine compost that you need to have a great-looking garden? We'll tell you how to do both those things. We'll also take more of your fascinating phone calls. But now it's time to welcome our old friend and special guest, Howard Garrett, known as the Dirt Doctor to tons of Texas organic gardeners. He has a syndicated radio show heard throughout Texas and the environs. He joins us today through the kind auspices of K-Sky in Dallas to talk about the mosquito issue. Howard, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. Good to hear from you.
It's good to be heard from. Now, this is happening in many places all over the country where people are afraid of West Nile virus and the municipalities have responded by spraying poisons over top of everybody. But it seems like you folks in Texas are being hit especially hard.
We have been. I don't know why it decided to set up shop here, but it did. And it's been larger than any year in the past, and we're trying to help people actually solve the problem, what they have done with airplanes and all. I'm very much against, because it doesn't work, and I'm trying to teach people how to actually control the mosquitoes. There's really only one mosquito we're concerned about, and it's the one that lives in stagnant, stinky water.
And that is theoretically the easiest mosquito to control if you were paying attention approximately 6 or 7 months ago, when apparently people weren't paying attention. So now we have to figure out what to do. Now, Howard, back when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, I seem to remember stumbling across this statistic that when these aerial sprays come out, that well below 0.1%, maybe like 0.001%, ever has the opportunity to even impact a target pest. Does that ring a bell with you?
Probably that or less, because the spray doesn't even get to the real problem, mosquitoes. It hits the tops of trees and the tops of houses and goes all over all kinds of hard surfaces. It kills a few of the adults that are flying around in the air, but the bulk of the problem is down in stagnant water and sewer lines and drainage lines, inside old tires and things like that, where the spray just simply doesn't contact the mosquitoes.
The one I'm always yelling at people about, and you know me, Howard, when I say I'm yelling at people, it's not just an expression, is I tell them very early in the spring, actually late winter, get up and check out your gutters. That is the unseen breeding ground for the mosquitoes that'll wind up biting you and perhaps giving you some illness in August.
Well, that's true. I think that's one of the main places where they get started. And the curious thing is that they're very easy to kill when they're in the water or in wet environments with BTI products. You can also kill them with various kinds of oils. But one of the things that I'm delighted about is that some of the people that produce the BTI products are starting to do them in much larger containers now. And we're having some luck getting the municipalities, both county and the cities, to look at buying the BT and starting to put it out themselves. But the most important part of it is to educate the people that they can do it also themselves at home. And we're trying to get the landscape industry into it. We're trying to get Boy Scouts. We're trying to get the churches. We're trying to get everybody around to think about getting on board this very simple program that we recommend that will actually control the mosquitoes.
As you and I know, you toss some of this naturally occurring stuff into stagnant water, and no mosquitoes can breed there for what, about a month?
About 30 days is what they say. It might last longer than that. One of the nice things about it is that the water can go dry and then re-wet, and they are still viable. You can even set up traps, which is what some of my entomologist friends and I have been scheming about lately, and that is to, in your bird baths at home, keep BT there on a regular basis, but also set up some additional containers that hold water. It can be old whiskey barrels. It can be pots. It can be anything that will hold water, and throw some grass clippings or something in it to actually set up a condition that will attract the Culex mosquito. In other words, we're setting up an attractant for them, and there'll be BT in that trap, and we can actually control them there even better. There are some commercial products on the market that use that same technology.
As an old Philadelphia boy, I like the aspect of revenge and kind of sucker punching some mosquitoes here. It's very appealing to me emotionally.
It'll really work, and you wouldn't have to set up very many. You could do it with some barrels or with some pots or with an old bucket or whatever, and just make sure you keep the BT applied, you know, every couple of weeks or 3 weeks or something, so you know it's fresh in there. And I think if we could get a lot of people doing that, we could really make a huge dent. My first step on mosquito control might surprise folks a little bit, and it is to clean up the trash. Have a very, very intense program for homeowners, for cities, for counties, for the state, for everybody. Because one day it finally dawned on me that if there's just pieces of plastic out laying around, old plastic bags or bottle caps or whatever, all of those things hold enough water to breed this Culex mosquito.
And we should remind people who are skittish about using anything, birds can drink from this water. They won't be harmed. Frogs and toads and salamanders can come and go from this water. they won't be harmed. There are secondary targets that do get knocked down unintentionally. If anybody out there enjoys the bite of a black fly, we apologize to them. BT will stop any fly. And I don't know about you, but I was astounded when I found out mosquitoes were in the fly family. Any biting fly that breeds in water will be stopped by BT. So it's not just mosquitoes. It's black flies. It's some varieties of those annoying gnats and midges that come after you.
One product that we're looking at right now to try to encourage the cities to, if they think that they must continue to spray from the air, there are some liquid forms of the BTI. And we're looking at that. We're also looking at the essential oils. One specific one used to be called Eco Exempt, and I think they've sold and they're changing the name of the company now. But the essential oils are extremely effective. Mosquitoes are on the label. And if people think that they must spray something in the air, that's what we push them toward, although I don't recommend it all that much because it gets the beneficial insects as well. But it is a pesticide that is a neurotoxin for insects, for invertebrates.
That makes me think of garlic barrier and mosquito barrier, these concentrated garlic oils that have been shown to be very effective as backyard foggers. I had a great experience you'll like hearing about. Here in the Philadelphia area, we had a big outdoor concert series at one of the older outdoor venues, and people were getting bit to death. They were trying to do opera, but all you could hear was slapping because these were nighttime performances. And I told them about the mosquito barrier, and they found they were able to buy a 55-gallon drum and spray this concentrated garlic oil. And after the next performance, people were coming up to them with grave concerns because it was clear there were no mosquitoes in the area. And what had you sprayed?
What they had sprayed. Yeah.
Were we safe being out there? But you know, the garlic smell goes away after a couple of hours, but the repellency lasts for weeks and weeks. And the garlic farmers use their, quote, garlic trash. They don't bust up good cloves, you know, rotten cloves maybe, but it's the garlic greens that get separated out as the material gets ready for market. And it's just a tremendous mosquito repellent. So, yeah, Howard, I can understand how in many communities, Texas, California, many southern states, this would be a year-round battle. But it also occurs to me that if you're taking care of standing water and you're doing prevention and you're paying attention year-round, maybe these mosquitoes don't really have a chance once we really start paying attention 24/7.
And I think the program will work. And for people who want to get my weekly free stuff, all you got to do is just send me an email, and I have your email address. You'll get our weekly free newsletter, and we'll continue to update everybody on our findings and our new ideas and techniques like the traps we talked about, and get everybody's suggestions as well. I love getting people to give me ideas that came from their gardens.
Exactly. I hadn't thought of the traps before you mentioned it. That will become part of my repertoire. On a good day, I might even credit you. All right, we've been talking to Howard Garrett, the Dirt Doctor, who is an organic broadcasting legend in Texas and the environs. He joined us from K-Sky in Dallas, and we will put a link to the Dirt Doctor up on our website when we air this interview. Howard, always a pleasure to speak with you. Great work you're doing on this mosquito problem. Keep it up.
Mike, you're the best. Talk to you soon.
And now, back to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Anissa, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Anissa. Where are you?
I'm in Bushnell, South Dakota.
Whoa, South Dakota. We don't get a lot of callers from South Dakota.
No, we're kind of out there.
And we're not on broadcast radio out there, are
we? No, I happened to come across you guys on a website.
Okay, excellent. So you heard our podcast?
Yes.
Excellent. South Dakota. There's another pin in the map, Alexis. All right. Very good to hear from you, Anisha. What can we do for you?
Well, I had called regarding a comment where it was mentioned we don't eat roses. And I thought, well, some of us do.
That was probably me. I was probably talking about the various things you can use to protect plants against insects. And at one point, I probably stupidly, I now admit, said, well, we don't eat roses, so blah, blah, blah. But one of the things I was fascinated by, and I hope this is what you're going to re-inform me of, when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, there were great discussions about how to utilize rose hips, and there were people
yes.
out there really utilizing, and we used to get questions all the time about which variety of rose to plant to get the biggest hips.
Well, and one of the things so many people don't realize is the distinction between the domestic roses and the wild roses. The wild rose is the one with a high vitamin C, and when people are trying to get when they combine both domestic rose hips and the wild rose hips, the domestic provide more of a berry flavor in their food products, where the vitamin C has the acid in it that's higher, and that's why you have that vitamin C. But three rose hips equals one orange. I mean, these are intense pieces of fruit when you think of the northern climates that can't produce citrus fruit in the natural outside environment.
Oh, so you're saying rose hips make it possible for people even in the far north to, mm-hmm. quote, grow their own vitamin C.
Yes, yes.
Now, how do you use your rose hips? You know, most people just prune them off and throw them away.
Well, and in my case, I actually am after the rose hip, even in my domestic roses. I love the smell all summer long. I love my rose bushes growing and having the beautiful fragrance of the roses. But my primary interest is rose hip. And so I'm careful I don't spray them with pesticides and that, and I just monitor my rose bushes. And then I use them to make rose hip jelly, rose hip jam, and also the essential oils. I'll use the petals to make rose water as well as essential oils. So I kind of use it in a multi-purpose format, and there's a lot of other ways. Some people are making syrups, medicinal syrups with it. And
give us an example of how you would process a rose hip to do something.
Well, when you collect, I mean, as anybody knows that grabs a rose bush, you got to deal with the thorns first off. You know, they don't give up their fruit readily, and throughout the bush, it's not just on the outer edges. There's going to be rose hips, and so I am always prepared with long sleeves, and I usually have a pair of gardening gloves, and I collect up the rose hips while they're still fresh and berry-like, not after they've dried out.
So this is right after the flowers have fallen off them?
Well, I usually do it later in the fall, so that because as in a lot of fruit items like apples and that, the frost kind of has a sweetening aspect to them, so I...
any of these plants, the first light frost is going to concentrate the sugars.
Right. And so that's when I usually go out and collect up the rose hips, and you take them in, and you want to separate that, I'm going to say, that star-like end of the berry off, and then you can either crush them with your fingers and open them up and put them in a bowl and collect them up and then boil them in the water and process them that way. Or some people are putting them into a sieve and separating out the juice from the pulp, and they're not wanting to keep any of the pulp and or the seeds. But now some people are getting the seeds, saving the seeds because of its medicinal value.
Do we know where the vitamin C is the highest in the various plant parts?
In the pulp. In the pulp is where it's really high.
Okay, so these people who were straining out the pulp were wrong.
Right. They're losing an aspect of it.
And but other than taking off that last stem of the faded flower, like top of a tomato, you process pretty much the whole hip.
The whole thing. Yep, the whole thing gets
processed.
Then
I guess it would be like a cranberry. You add sugar and go through the basic process of making preserves.
Yes, and then you just follow that basic process.
And what do you do with the petals? I know many people who make rose water just for fun and for a fragrance, but I've also heard from people who eat the petals.
Yeah, and I've never done the eating the petals straight up, but I was introduced because of a friend who was from Iran to rose water rice.
And, oh, that sounds fabulous already.
Yeah, and they tend to use it to give, you know, because the culinary process to them should be both visual, aromatic, as well as taste well. And so one of the things they'll do is use rose water or orange water and add it into the foods, and that's one of the things I really like rose water for.
All right, Anisha, you remind us that there are many plants in our environment that are edible that we ignore. And thank you for sharing your thoughts on rose hips and rose petals with us. And I'll remind everyone out there that I personally have found roses to be some of the hardiest and strongest plants. And I can't think of a plant that needs chemicals less than roses. Just give them airflow, morning sun, a mulch of compost, and they'll produce like mad for you. All right, Anisha, thank you very much.
You have a good day.
You too. Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind folks with tender plants still outside not to delay. Houseplants, tropicals, peppers, begonias, impatiens, and such should come inside before nighttime temps dip below 40 degrees. And be sure to rinse them off first with strong streams of water to deter aphids and other hitchhiking pests. But don't go looking for all the details under the letter W for winter in the A to Z Garden Answer section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and exactly how to get the most out of those priceless fall leaves you're about to be graced with. I'm Graceful Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, the national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds gardeners that fall is the ideal time to plant gourmet garlic, perennial plants, bulbs for spring blooms, and especially fruit plants. More information at burpee.com.
You're listening to You Bet Your Garden on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Arden Theater Company, presenting the winner of the 2010 Pulitzer for Drama and Tony Award-winning Next to Normal, now on stage through November 4th. This electric and emotional musical follows one family's struggle to maintain connection amidst crisis. Set to a contemporary score, Next to Normal's bold storytelling expands the scope of subject matter for musicals. For tickets, 215-922-1122 or normalinphilly.com.
WHYY is supported by Works For Me, funded by CMS grant CFDA number 93.768. Works For Me offers hiring tips, training, and help finding employees. Details at worksforme-pa.org/employer.
Oh, excuse me. Runners, don't forget the Race for Public Media. The 4th annual Y12K Road Race is Saturday, November 10th, and you can register today at whyy.org/Y12K.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up in a little bit, the precious leaves that are the basis of a successful organic garden are about to fall. We must harness the power of these leaves to make the best garden mulch and to make premium compost. But exactly how do you do that? And exactly how do you make that compost fast despite winter cold slowing it down? We'll give you all the answers to those questions after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Lance, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello there. How you doing, Mike?
I'm doing good, Lance. How are you, sir?
Good. I'm Skip Back, Pennsylvania.
Okay, I know where that is. What can we do for Lance in Skip Back?
I have a couple railroad ties outside my back door. There's a small patio, and they're leaning. So I'm going to do a project where I'm going to take them off and basically landscape the soil there. But right there's two azaleas there. And I want to move them back maybe a foot because they're encroaching on the patio. They're two nice azaleas. I don't want to lose them. I want to move them back, and I'm not sure to do it now or in the spring.
Okay,
or
so
when's the best time to do that.
Okay, so I'm more concerned with the railroad ties.
Okay.
You realize these are the most toxic substances that homeowners can...
They're not real railroad ties. They look like ties, but they're smaller, and they're not the creosote type.
But what are they treated with?
That's a good question. That I don't know.
Yeah. Do not touch them without gloves.
Okay.
Okay, do not handle them. I'm going to presume it's old school CCA pressure-treated lumber.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, that's chromium, copper, and arsenic. The chromium.
Oh, God.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, no, these things should not be near children, near people, near water supplies. I don't know if you intend to reuse them, but
I was planning on it. Yeah,
if
I don't have to.
If it were I would take them to a toxic waste disposal site, a hazardous waste collection area, and get rid of them. Do not touch them with your bare hands. If they are starting to crack and parts of them are starting to fall apart, wear a dust mask as well, and don't touch the soil that was next to them with your bare hands. It could be loaded with chromium and arsenic.
Okay.
And then if you need something to shore up to make a rise there, use pavers or stone or something that's nice and inert.
Okay, gotcha.
Okay. Now, your azaleas, how old are they? How tall are they?
They are around, 3 foot tall, I'd say, by 3 foot wide. And they've been there for at least 19 years.
So you prune them?
Yes.
When have you been pruning?
Spring mostly.
After they flower?
Yes.
Okay. Are you sure? You're lying to me, Lance?
No. that's what I do.
Okay. Because you already know the right time to do this then.
So that is good then, because they have the most energy then, right?
Correct. And what's going on now is the plants are going dormant for the winter, but they've already formed all their flower buds for next year.
They're already formed.
Yes. Okay. Oh, yeah. They've been formed for a couple of weeks, if not months now.
Okay.
And azaleas are very shallow-rooted, and the roots are very sensitive. So you're going to shock them when you move them. I would do is, especially if you can do this whenever you want, I would leave them alone through winter, let them finish blooming next year.
Right.
Then you can cut them back, make them easier to handle. And then when you dig them up, try not to harm the roots. Think of the roots as very sensitive. They have some of the most sensitive roots of any plant.
Okay. I didn't know that.
Have the new hole dug and make sure there's a, you refill the hole mostly with your native soil, with the regular soil you have. But but mix a little peat moss in because they like an acidic soil.
Okay.
And then when you replant them, put down 1 inch of milled peat moss around them as a mulch and cover that with 1 inch of compost and then let a hose drip at their base for an entire day. Just drip, drip, drip. After you move them and make sure they get that kind of deep watering for several hours once a week, anytime we don't have rain during the entire season following that.
And then
they should recover really well. Their roots are very sensitive. They're very water-thirsty plants. But as you say, after their flowers are gone, that's when they begin growing again. That's when they have the most energy. That's when they like to be pruned. That's the best time to prune them. That's also the best time to move them. Make sure their soil is nice and rich and acidic. Don't use any wood mulch. Don't use any chemical fertilizers or plant spikes. And make sure they keep getting watered during dry times.
Okay, gotcha.
All right, man?
All right, sounds great.
Good luck, Lance.
Appreciate it.
Take care.
Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Janice, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, how you doing?
Oh, we're okay, Janice. How are you?
I'm very well.
And where is Janice very well?
In Cape May Point, New Jersey.
All right, down the shore. What can we do for Janice by the Atlantic Ocean?
Well, I have a Meyer lemon tree, which is in a pot, and I bought it online a couple years ago. The first year I had it, it just grew tall and spindly and looked really sad. I brought it inside for the winter, and it lost all of its leaves, and I thought it died. So then I went online, and it said that people who grow Meyer lemons commercially really prune these trees back severely.
Oh.
So I did this year. Now, wait a minute. This year, it is lush and green with tons of branches and everything.
Okay. You lucked out.
Okay, but it isn't flowering.
Well, when did you prune it?
In the spring.
See, citrus trees are kind of backwards to us. They typically follow a very different season. Indoor citrus, typically, now I don't grow it myself, but my understanding is its propensity is to produce its fruit in the winter time, and they have very specific needs. Now, when you got it, what did you pot it up into, and what did you use as the potting soil?
I just used a potting soil, an organic potting soil that I got at a nursery.
Okay. And did you add anything to it?
I did not.
And have you ever fed the plant?
I fed it in the springtime. I bought these little plugs that you put down in the soil, watered it, moved it outside, and it grew.
So you bought chemical spikes?
I guess, yeah, probably.
Yeah, you're doing a bunch of things that are going to prevent fruit.
Okay.
The soil with an indoor citrus plant is really important. It has to hold moisture well, and it has to drain exceptionally well. And it should be naturally rich. So that's a reason to make a potting soil for your plant out of half compost and half soil-free mix. No water-holding crystals, no nutrients in the potting soil of any kind, just peat perlite, vermiculite, and maybe a little bit of compost, a nice soil-free mix like people use for seed starting, and mix that 50-50 with compost. Now, what kind of a container is it in?
It's in a heavy plastic big container. It's like 18 inches at the top.
Okay, good. So it's in plastic.
Right.
Okay, good, because that retains water well. When you water it, is there a dish under it to collect the extra water?
No, because it's on a sort of a walkway that's like a boardwalk with slats in it, you know, so it's
what about when
drain.
It's in, what about when it's inside?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And that, do you allow water to sit in that?
Yes.
Okay, that has to stop.
Okay.
That has to stop. Those saucers are only to protect surfaces. You should never see any water in them.
Okay.
And the way to avoid that is get used to the weight of your plant. Rock it back and forth. When it needs water, you'll see it feels light. After you water it, you'll see it feels heavy. When the time comes to water your plant, and these plants like more water than most house plants, especially in the winter, what you want to do is add small amounts.
Okay.
They need incredibly bright light in the winter time. What are you giving them?
It gets morning sun mostly.
That's just it?
That's pretty much, yeah.
Okay. That may be why it started to get scraggly. Every time you prune it, you're going to limit the possibility of getting flowers and fruit. So what I recommend, do you have a south-facing window or a little knockout window, like a horticultural window where it can get sun all day?
I don't have that, but I have the south-facing one, yes.
And would that get more sun there?
Probably, yeah, different room.
Okay. Well, if you think it's not getting 6 to 8 hours of sun a day, and don't forget the sunlight in the wintertime is much weaker, comes at a different angle, there's not a lot of photosynthesis in it, I would rig up a shop light, just a simple 4-foot-long shop light with two tubes, 240-watt tubes, hang it over one of these windowsills, and put your potted citrus under it, and then some other house plants under it as well. Let it get the natural light plus those 240-watt fluorescent tubes, ideally one cool white, one warm white. Keep it really warm in the winter, too. Try to not to put it in a place where the temperature is going to drop down at night and then be warm during the day. A lot of old windows are really inappropriate places for plants.
Oh.
But do those couple of things, and you'll get those beautiful, fragrant flowers and then some fruits. But I don't advise pruning it.
Okay.
All right?
Yes, thank you so much.
All right. Good luck, Janice.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. How to turn fall leaves into a great summer garden. Joanna Hatzis, production assistant for You Bet Your Garden, please read off this week's two fascinating questions.
Jean in Wincote, PA writes, last summer I built a bin and filled it in the fall with shredded leaves. The bin had a cover as designed, but in the spring the volume of shredded leaves was only slightly reduced and just the smallest amount of compost was in the very bottom. We really want the results to be better next year. We've already decided to remove the cover. What else should we do to get that rich-looking, completely degraded compost you see in gardening books by next spring? And we also heard from Robert in Tallahassee, Florida, who writes, I have several piles of shredded yard waste, mostly leaves. All the piles are dry and dusty inside. The bottom of the pile gets some moisture from the ground, but the top just sheds the rain right off. What can I do?
Well, that's perfect timing, guys. The priceless leaves that are the basis of proper compost and mulch making are about to fall, and this is a great time to prepare to use them well. Now, down in Tallahassee and other warm winter climes, leaves collected and shredded late in the season should be almost completely composted by the spring, unless the pile gets dry, which slows the process down considerably. Where rain is scarce, you should water your pile occasionally. If the top is shedding water, break it up a little with a pitchfork or turn it by forking the material over to another spot to mix the damp leaves with the dry. If you don't want to or can't engage in that type of labor, there's a really handy tool known as a compost aerator. You can plunge in and then pull out of the pile. It slides in straight like an arrow, but little wings pop out on the upstroke, really mixing things up. In the north, however, the reality of winter sets in. It gets cold right after we collect and shred those leaves. And as many of us know all too well, personally, biological processes slow down in the cold. If trees were more considerate, they'd drop their leaves in the spring. And covering your compost pile is a bad idea in all but the rainiest climates. You may compost the fastest when the material stays damp, and winter rains and snow often add just the right amount of moisture to the mix. But there's still that darn cold to contend with, so here are some ways to help things cook a little bit faster. Always shred your leaves before using them as mulch or to make compost. Whole leaves mat down like a tarp, keeping air and water out of compost piles and any soil they may be foolishly covering. In the wild, trees use their leaves to suppress competition on the forest floor by smothering littler plants. So shredded your leaves must be. The best tools to accomplish this task are chipper shredders, leaf blowers that have a reverse vacuum setting, dedicated leaf shredders that fit on top of trash cans, and bagging lawnmowers. Try double shredding your leaves. The smaller the particle, the faster it becomes compost. My leaves were also a little slow to degrade last winter, so I plan to run them through my leaf vac twice this fall. A little extra work from which I expect big rewards. Give them some nitrogen. Mixing a rich source of nitrogen in with your fall leaves will move the process along much faster and keep it going longer in cold weather. Give them some nitrogen. Mixing a rich source of nitrogen in with your fall leaves will move the process along much faster and keep it going longer into cold weather. I've been hoarding and collecting used coffee grounds all summer for this task. They're super rich in nitrogen, add moisture to the pile, don't attract vermin, and are readily available. Ask your local coffee shop for their used grounds, and/or take the used grounds home from the coffee station at work. If you have an untreated lawn, running a bagging mower over it to shred your leaves up with some grass clippings makes for a perfect compost mixture. Like coffee grounds, grass clippings are a great source of moisture and nitrogen. But don't use clippings from a lawn that's been treated with chemical herbicides. The resulting compost could kill next year's plants. Put a chimney in the middle. Roll some animal fencing into a tube that'll be taller than your stack of raw ingredients. Place it in the center of the area you're going to use, and then pile the contents around it. That compost chimney will allow air and water to reach the parts of the pile that are always the most recalcitrant. But whatever you do, even if it's only collecting and shredding your leaves, be sure to collect and shred them. The natural energy and nutrition in those leaves is the finest fuel your garden can have. If all you do is pile the shredded leaves up in a big bin, a composter, or even this season's tomato cages, you'll have some finished compost on the bottom by spring. And any uncomposted leaves will cook down very quickly in the spring. Or use those shredded leaves as your garden mulch, and earthworms will feed your plants for free. Well, that sure was some helpful advice about using your fall leaves to fuel next year's garden, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over carefully and follow the links to other hot composting tricks, just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to leave me leafless if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Like us on Facebook. Put the actual subject in the subject line. Like us on Facebook. And check first to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems just like yours in our Garden Answers A to Z section. And or listen to this show, listen to old shows, download this week's podcast, and or like us on Facebook already. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week has been Bob Alls. Baneful Rich Banowitz and Savage Sarah Kazar are our web-headed wonders. Check out their fine work at our newly designed and really nifty website. The well-shredded Amanda McGrath is our social media director. Completely composted Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our well-hydrated production assistants are Joanna Hatzis and Brett Rader. Coffee ground hoarder extraordinaire Al Banks is our esteemed editor. I'm your host with a chimney in the middle, Mike McGrath, making sure I stay full of hot air until I can see you next week. It's time for the second season of Great Growing. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal a dozen things you can and should plant over the next month or so, plus your fabulous phone calls.
Mike's effervescent eloquence enables us to elicit exquisite edelweiss, evergreen, evening primrose, even earthworms. Join us for You Bet Your Garden at 11 Saturday mornings here on WHYY.
Morristown Friends School proudly supports WHYY and is hosting an admissions open house on Sunday, October 21st at 2 p.m. Founded in 1785, Morristown Friends offers rigorous academics coupled with a spiritual and ethical education program for students in preschool through grade 12. More information, multimedia, and all open house dates, including information about Morristown Friends at